Welcome to Coffee with Questions, the adult discussion group at the Tree of Life Unitarian Universalist Congregation in McHenry, Illinois. It is Sunday morning. August 28th, and this morning we're discussing Paul Tillich and climate change. Our facilitator will be Russ Marks.
Hans Jonas writes, "We are the first generation forced to ask the question whether there will be future generations." What's your response to this?
That's false. Every generation is forced to ask the question.
We are the first generation forced to ask the question whether there will be future generations.
It's every generation asks this question.
So there's nothing new to this question?
No, it's a false statement. You
know
me.
Alan, anybody can ask, but I think as a group, as a society, we have questioned it because of changes in the world.
Well, what we question is that now it's us. All right? Before, it was them.
Well, I'd say there's been various changes on it over the course of history. 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago, it was nip and tuck whether the tigers would get you, and that would be the end of human being. Then a generation ago, it was the atom bomb. That was going to destroy everybody. Now it's the fear of the end of the world is always there. It's just got a new expression.
In any case, this is a quotation from Hans Jonas.
Yeah, well, it's not.
I thought Russ
invited us to discuss it.
Well, Russ asked me to respond.
Well, I think, though, that, I don't know, I'm kind of guessing that with the advent of the atomic bomb, I think that probably is the first time that the whole world is asking if there are going to be future generations. It's true that even in ancient times, because people's concept of what the world was and how big it was and, you know, what constituted the world, they might have thought that way because they didn't know there was a whole other side of the planet. So maybe it amounts to the same thing. But I think with the atomic bomb started that fear that we, everybody on the planet, we might annihilate ourselves.
The doomsday clock.
I'm not familiar with the timeline here. When did Jonas make this quote?
In the 70s.
Was he pernicious enough to know to be talking about climate change, or was he talking about the atomic energy?
Climate change.
He was talking about climate change.
Yeah, he was back then.
So he was ahead of his time.
Why was he not talking about the atomic bomb?
Well, the atomic bomb, was it that much of a threat at that point?
I don't know.
Is it something you view as a constant threat? Is it a threat today?
It still is. Yes, of course. You can destroy the world how many times over?
If ISIS gets one of those things, we're in big trouble.
Even though there are enough bombs to destroy the world many times over, it's still very likely that some places won't be immediately affected. There may be all kinds of long-term results, but it's not likely to drop a bomb on Africa.
The commonplace in the political sphere is that the reason the atom bomb hasn't been dropped again is MACD. I think it's MACD.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Assured destruction.
Mutual destruction. I think I got the wrong letters here.
Mutual destruction.
MAD.
Mutual assured destruction.
That's right.
Whatever. It means that if somebody drops that bomb, they're going to get bombed themselves, and therefore the beginning of the end of the world.
That's right.
Well,
I'm sorry?
It's the acronym for the word MAD.
Yeah.
Well, there it is. And the world is so frightened by that that nobody's willing to drop it first.
Well, there are people that are mad people that might do it. So it's a possibility.
Well, we're all old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Sure, of course, yeah.
Right. I mean, we were on edge.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't remember it.
And then, of course, you're just a kid, Tom. And then, of course, there was the film Doctor Strange.
Oh, that was a good one. Yes, that was a good one.
Yeah.
So this is very interesting to me that you view climate change as just another chapter in problems that confront us. There's nothing new. There's nothing new about the threat of climate change.
I didn't hear anybody saying that. You need to take the word just away. Otherwise, what you said is correct. But it's not just that. Yeah. It's also that.
Yeah, I think we have two perhaps independent big problems about the survival of the human race.
Probably climate change will be slow and the atomic bomb, hydrogen bomb, that'll be a quick way. Climate change will be.
And I think you put your finger on it. Climate change has been creeping up on us.
Sure.
Where a nuclear war would be abrupt and devastating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Climate change. Have we reached a tipping point? Have we not reached a tipping point? Will it ruin our economy if we change? None of those questions like that don't come up so much in the discussion about nuclear war.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Science fiction writers did a lot of that. It did come up.
What
will life be after the nuclear holocaust?
Oh, okay, you mean like dystopian science fiction?
No, not, well, some were that, some were scaremongers.
Yeah.
But you know, world was going to be different so the writers could imagine whatever they wanted.
It would seem as though one of the characteristics of this is what I just heard from Don, that it's creeping up on us, and the issue is whether you even notice that it's happening.
In fact, it's
like that analogy with the frog. Mm-hmm. If you put it in warm water and you increase the temperature just a little tiny bit, it never jumps out. It gets fried because it didn't notice that it was boiled.
Atomic destruction is simple. You look at it, you can see obviously what it's going to do, whereas climate change is not simple. And most people don't even understand it.
In fact, I'll make one small change. Somebody said it will be slow. Let's say it is slow. It has been slow and it continues to be slow.
And it's so slow that some people don't want to believe that it's happening.
And it's not simple, just like Tom said. If you read that book by the guy Jeffrey Sachs, who's the head of the Earth Institute of Columbia, you'll see that his thesis is a huge book, 600 pages. There's no one answer. It isn't just warm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's dozens of things. Too warm in South Africa, in the Sahara Desert area, which is expanding. But it's also, at the same time, melting the ice cap. It's also, at the same time, causing Greenland to be more productive and have more agriculture, and the threats are different in different places, and there's different kinds of responses that need to be made, and it's not just some magic wand. You can just disappear the whole thing.
And you're right. It's very different for different places.
And what Rush mentioned a little while ago, what about the sun? You know, sunspots and sun controls our climate a lot also.
Countries will actually have to work together.
Of course.
And that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because
countries don't want it to work together.
But even in the United States, they're, you know, probably, I mean, judging by the votes that most people cast, it seems like we're at about 50% that really believes it's happening.
It's a shame, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the nationalization.
It's going to be worse than a shame.
Bill.
Matter that Tom just mentioned also. You're seeing that happening in the world today. We did have this movement for greater global consciousness, noticing, I like to say, beginning to notice that the border between Canada and America doesn't affect the drift of this smoke that's hurting the air. It didn't take any notice when it crossed the national lines, and so you knew you needed to have a transnational response, and now the political world is actually reversing its attitude, and we see Brexit going on, and we see people like Trump wanting to close our borders and all that, and exaggerating the national identities as a reaction,
yeah,
against...
There's a real surge of nationalism.
That's right. It's going on.
I can't make a very good case for it, but I think a lot of scientists would really say that the people in this table are pretty much in denial over what climate change means and its impact on the world and what our future looks like. This is a projection into the future, but it's also a projection about what's happening now. And what's happening now, you can see on the daily news. Every day on the daily news, there is some climate change disaster. Whether it's flooding, whether it's forest fires, whether it's the pollution of the oceans, whether it's the melting of the glaciers, there's some kind of disaster occurring in the world, and this is creeping up on us, but it's beginning to get where it's to the point where we can't fool around any longer. Obama recognizes this.
Did you say when you, right before, as you began to speak, that the people at this table were in denial?
Yes.
This table here?
This table here.
Okay,
no,
this
you're right, Ross. Right.
Just from the remarks.
Our lifestyles prove that. It's
well,
true.
What would you recommend, Russ, that what? We do?
Or why would you say... Yeah. Could you explain more why you think the people at this table are in denial? Because I myself don't feel like I'm in denial.
Who said what? He gave you that.
Yeah. Well, that was just to liven the conversation.
Oh, yes, you did that.
He was saying if we were listening.
You're pulling a Donald
Trump. Well, there is another way to look at this. I mean, Jerry Falwell said natural disaster in New York City was a result, and in New Orleans was a result of homosexuality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look on
which
what...
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Can you disprove of that theory?
I look on what Russ just said. Russ himself jumping out of his own past by raising his voice and showing a little more passion at this table, yeah, and is one of the possibilities and powers of our conversation. Thank you, Russ, for jumping out.
What would you recommend the government or the people or
let's just take the media, for example. Why doesn't the media talk about this clear example I'm talking about, these continuous floods, tornadoes?
Yeah.
Why don't they talk about that in terms
of
climate change?
Define the media.
Yeah, it depends on what media you engage with. NPR talks about it all the time.
I was listening to them talk about it this morning, actually, the boot shape of Louisiana. They were saying that so much of Louisiana goes into the ocean because of climate change. It's not shaped like a boot anymore. It's shaped like a deformed foot.
Hey, Ross, you made
and
a point.
We ought to do something about that.
You made a point about the economy, and if we were to address climate change, how it might hurt the economy. And my opinion is that the media is actually ran The media isn't the people you see on television. The media is way up.
Yeah.
And they're telling these people what
people
to say.
Yes.
And these people would be hurt if we addressed climate change. It's going to affect the economy if we address it.
So it's advertising.
But I think that there's ways to at least curb that a little bit. I think that there are industries that could at least help slow it down. It's just that there's such fierce competition by people like the Koch brothers, you know, people who are fighting making any kind of change and who have gotten enormously rich and enormously powerful. But, like, for one thing, there's some things happening at state and local levels. For one thing, my daughter just got back last March from 4 years in California, and she said they have there some kind of a process that, like, you know how when you put things in recycling, you have to, like, clean off every molecule practically or they won't take it. Apparently in California they have equipment that will clean it.
Oh, yeah.
So then the people who say, I'm too busy because I don't have time to rinse it off, they don't have to worry about that because they can just turn it in and the equipment cleans it. But it's a big, it's expensive and it's a big investment. And I believe that that's a place where the federal government can step in to get things going in every state.
I'd like for just a second, Alan, I don't know if I understood you correctly, but I think I heard you say that our lifestyles demonstrate that we don't really believe it. Something
we
like
don't
that.
Concur to the gravity of it and the meaning of it. No.
Okay. How might our lifestyles reflect if we did? What might we do differently?
We do what Jesus said to do. He told us what to do.
Which is?
He says to take it all and give it to the poor and follow me. And that means all.
Yeah,
you don't hold on to anything. If we were more postured like that, more, I can't say. That's what she said in the last time we were at church. She says, I can't follow him either.
Yeah.
But if we did that more than we are doing it, considerably more, then we wouldn't be contributing so much. But since we aren't, and we're not, okay, then we are. That was what I meant.
What you're basically saying is downsize, simplify. You don't need all this stuff that you have, and just do the basic things that you need, and that's it.
And look at wind and solar, though.
Sure.
Really,
of course, yeah.
Look at air conditioning.
Sure.
Are we willing to completely get rid of it?
Because I don't have it.
We have to.
Yeah,
Heather's over there.
Build it underground.
No, I'm not willing.
Neither am I.
If you build an underground house, you don't need it.
Well, yeah, you got an underground
house.
Well, the general argument, however, has a certain plausibility to it. Is it really the case that the world depends on how fast we can dig up the earth and turn it into junk and then throw it out?
Yeah.
Or is it perfectly possible that a simpler lifestyle is actually more suitable to human beings? I never forget, I went into the house of a prospect once, a very wealthy woman. She had one child, and she had a playroom in the ground floor of her house.
Yeah.
And she led me into her living room, and she opened the door to the playroom. The playroom was so full of toys, a person could not even get into that room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what good is that to this little daughter of hers?
Yeah.
You can't even get into it. You're so overwhelmed with all the junk. That doesn't have to happen.
In fact, I was all ready to protest when you said, we can simplify and have less. And I started to protest. Well, I don't have anything now. I'm driving a new car.
Uh-oh.
That's why my protestation kind of...
What'd you get?
Toyota Camry.
Yeah.
Hybrid.
Yeah.
My brother-in-law has a completely electric car. So is his son, and they don't make them anymore.
And those are, Tesla's prices. Tesla's come out with lower price
is yours
models.
A Tesla?
Hmm?
You said it was a Toyota. Yeah.
Wind and solar seem to be something that can be done. It makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And where it's only tried on a very teeny level.
We're doing it here, Mike. Yeah, my brother-in-law put in the solar panels at the high school there, and they do wind, you know.
Nothing wrong with trying it on a tiny level. Makes good sense to experiment first to see what works. Mm-hmm. Sure. Has anybody heard that they're paving a stretch of Route 66 with solar cells?
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
I think I did.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm trying. I either heard that or something else. There was something, and I really wish I could remember details of this, but there was something about a solar array being built in a valley.
There are a number of solar arrays around the world.
Yeah, and there's roofing now that's solar. You can put the roof and it's a solar roof.
Yeah, and they're even talking about self-contained homes that rely on solar in the summer, and during the winter they rely on wind.
And they're not just talking about them, they've been built.
Yeah, exactly.
50 years ago, solar power was a figment of the imagination. We are looking at solar power now because we are aware of the damage that normal power generation from coal fossil fuel plants does to the environment. But it takes time to do that. It takes money to do that. It takes government incentive to do that. I think that the government years ago mandated catalytic converters on cars to help improve the air quality. If the government had not done that, we might have done it now, but it certainly would not have been done as quickly. And then people talk about the economic burden of government regulations and the over-regulation of society.
What this all has to do with the other part of what Russ has gotten on his paper there would seem to me somewhat along these lines, that there's two possible ways to respond to this threat. One is, I don't want to have to be preoccupied with anything that's fearful, so therefore I'm going to try to keep it out of my mind. I'm going to watch TV and I'm going to drink a lot of alcohol or drugs or whatever so that I don't have to notice the things that frighten me. That's one possible reaction. The other possible reaction is getting so hyped up about it that I don't give any kind of real thought to it. I just go throwing huge amounts of money at it, bankrupt the country, and then only discover that all the things that I did were not effective after all. And then there's a third possibility, which is you bring the fear level. You don't ignore it, but you don't also get wiped out by it, so that you can't do a damn thing that makes any kind of sense, and you apply the full range of human possibility toward dealing with it in a manner that enables that the human race continues in some mode or other.
But I think that one of the problems with that is, this has come up before, the fact that it is a complex issue and that it seems like there are just a lot of people in the United States anyway, that don't seem to be able to handle complexity, and things are just more cut and dry to them, and so they can't, they see these either ors rather than seeing the complexity, and when you see complexity, you see more possibilities.
I agree with you, and it is characteristic of our culture, especially here in America, to go to extremes. I'm either all right or I'm all wrong.
And actually, I understand that solar power, for example, is now competitive, probably cheaper than coal.
Mm-hmm. Really?
But it's going to require a complete redesign of the electrical distribution system, which would be great because we need to spend money.
Well, you know, doesn't it create jobs?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But there has to be government help. I just really think there has to be government help.
There has been.
Help and leadership.
Leadership, yes. We've got some of because but leadership is divided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what government are you talking about, Iris? Are you talking about the U.S. government as though the U.S. alone could handle this global problem?
But
we can certainly be leaders.
I just want to know, because this other situation is that the governments are multiform, and even sometimes when you say it's the government, the government is the result of the pressure groups in the country and so on and so on. So that
even in Illinois, I understand we have more governments than any other state in the union.
We're overwhelmed by these governments, and we throw our money away in these governments, and so we don't have it left over to do the things that should be done, and so on and so on.
And even if in this country we wanted to go completely green, solar energy, no carbon based fuels to generate power. Countries like India are saying we don't have the technology or the means to do that. We should be exempt from these anti-pollution requirements until we can afford to do it.
That's right, and that's a pretty compelling argument at some levels because, down in South America and Brazil and so on, where they're destroying the forests, and they're saying to us, you rich folks want to tell us to stop chopping down the forest. You already chopped down all your forests, so that's how you came to be so wealthy.
Yep.
Now you just want to dominate everybody else and tell us how not to, so we're supposed to starve to death so that you can have your trees to keep your precious air clean.
That's
the kind of attitude you see down there.
That ain't the people in South America that are talking that way. Those are bankers in New York.
what's the difference?
The big difference? The difference is it's not them down there, it's us.
Alan, do you think for a minute?
We're the ones that do this kind of con job.
Do you think for a minute that the native peoples in South America do not object to cutting the forests?
I have a feeling that they get plenty of blame and they don't need any more blaming, and they don't need to be characterized and slandered in a euphemistic way like we were just doing.
Are you saying that's what you interpret on that? I said,
which is usually calling being a bigot. Yeah, we're just used to being a bigot.
Well, Brazil seems to be muddling through. Some people thought that the Olympic Games would be a complete disaster.
Yeah, and they were. Did you notice that?
No,
it was wonderful.
They were not exactly.
No.
They were not what?
They were not a disaster.
No, they were. They were fine.
And you get closer to things, and they become more complex. Brazil, they're trying the premier, the prime minister. But the assistant prime minister from the opposite party, there's also moves to what's the term when you
impeach?
There are also moves to impeach him.
Dilma Rousseff.
And yet that didn't particularly interfere with the Olympic Games. Right. I think they're doing some good things.
It was interesting at the Olympic Games, they had a really nice tribute in terms of looking at climate change and what it's doing to the planet. I thought that was very
appropriate. Now they're going to have the next Olympics in Tokyo, okay? Now, mark my word, when it's in Tokyo, you won't hear any of this talk. Why? Because Tokyo is wealthy. You'll hear this talk about Rio, because they're poor, okay? Our brains are stuck. Okay. And any of us that think that we're above this and we're not being fooled and that we're not full of stereotypes and we're not bigots. As bad as Trump is, at least he is really making a case for this. You know, that the bigotry is it's flailing out there everywhere. Okay.
I'm not a bigot. Anybody at this table a bigot?
Yes, I'm
probably a bigot.
There are times that I make judgments, and there are times that I make judgments.
Okay, right. It's to a degree.
We're all bigots.
At a low level.
Let's plan a group suicide or something like
that. Why do we have to be suicide? Just because we're a human being.
How about this, Ellen? Would you take this as a compromise? So, how about if we blame, I'm trying to work this out of my head, what is the cause of so much poverty, let's say in Brazil, what is the cause of so much poverty if those people were not poor, and if it's not their fault that they're poor, if there's, you know, it's kind of like everybody in this country who starts, you know, the deck is stacked to a certain extent.
Wait,
could I just finish?
Yeah, let her so if we, and you can get yours in.
So really what needs to happen is for the poverty to be addressed, and then they won't need to cut down those trees because they will have other sources of income. So it's not that the poor need to be indicted, it's that whatever governmental and oligarchical situation is creating and sustaining that poverty, that's kind of where the ball needs to be thrown. Yeah. They need to do something.
And I hear you. And after you talk, I'll talk, because I had 10 minutes ago I wanted to say something about this, but I was listening.
Say it now if you need to.
Well, I don't need to, but in the people that lived here before us, that lifestyle, the natives could, that lifestyle, it was sustainable, it would last for tens of thousands of years. And I think it was Thomas Paine that wrote something about the Native Americans here, and then the British said, Native Americans in their tribe, there's no poor people. Everybody shares everything.
Most of them.
And that's what he observed. Yeah. The native tribes he observed. Right. But in England, he couldn't. Who's the savage? And who's the civilized person? So that's my only point there.
Okay.
I wanted to say, we were talking about impoverished people. We're sitting here, and there's another point to this, but we're sitting here drinking coffee. And a lot of the people, I bet, and I really don't know for sure, but I bet a lot of people who are involved in the production of coffee are very poor people. Hundreds of years ago, History always has an answer. The British people, the good British people, were talking about not consuming sugar. And it would really hurt their tea drinking. But they were thinking of that because the people who made the sugar were for the most part slaves. And if we were to stop consuming some of the things that these practically slaves are making today, it would affect it. But we insist on our lavish lifestyle. We insist on having things that actually hurt other people to make. Mm-hmm. Are we willing to give up? Like, for instance, our cars, our beautiful Toyotas. Would you be willing to go back to horses? That might solve some of the problems.
This is a really complex thing, though, because those slaves are earning cash which they can spend in their economy. Now, before, maybe they didn't need cash because they raised their own food. And, you know, we do a little bit of that here. Within the church, there are people who raise their own food and sell it locally. And those are, I think, but there's no way that we can support the world population or the U.S. population with that kind of arrangement.
Mass starvation.
Yeah. We could have fair trade coffee at the church. That would be good.
We have had in the past when somebody was willing to take the trouble to make it available.
I see.
And then, so we don't use it now, but we did in the past?
Well, we used to have fair trade coffee on sale after the service.
And we used it to make coffee.
And we used it, okay.
And it was the Green Sanctuary Committee
that
spearheaded that and went through the process of vetting all the coffee suppliers and decided on where to go. It's more expensive.
And the leadership
of
that.
You have to be willing.
Yeah.
Well, it couldn't be that much more expensive.
For
my cup of coffee, no, but for the whole church.
Work on this. You haven't worked on the church budget.
Okay.
But it is a real question. I mean, there are various stands we could take.
In fact, for a while, maybe while we were doing that, we had a contribution dish out at the coffee table.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Help cover the added costs.
That would be good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People that can afford it could put it.
I don't understand what this conversation has to do with the rest of the agenda.
Agriculture is.
Why are we talking about nothing except these ethical issues? Bob brought up this. Why shouldn't we just commit suicide since we discover we're all involved in what is not being done properly?
I wasn't serious about that.
I think you should be serious about it, because that is part of the threat that is addressed by the other questions. Or did you leave those out somehow or other for this presentation?
Oh, they're all there.
The Tillich part of it.
Yeah.
In the very brief moments that I had when I wasn't listening, I read the 5 comments about grace.
Yes.
But that's...
What are those all about?
Yeah.
Let's talk about grace.
You actually made a connection in the paragraph above that, because you're saying that according to Tillich, man was separated from himself, others, and the ground of his being. Mm-hmm. And then skip a sentence. It says, man now is fundamentally separated from nature, which reflects upon the separation of himself. So, et cetera. So... is that the connection that you see? The separation of man from nature is leading to these?
Yeah, and that has to do with the global climate change as well.
So how could grace, do you want grace to be part of this conversation?
We bring in grace in terms of the separation you have with climate change, the denial of climate change happening, and then how do you get to grace when you have that kind of separation operating? Tillich writes that grace strikes us when we are in great pain or restlessness. Is this part of your understanding of what's involved with grace and separation?
Well, the way I interpret that, first of all, it doesn't mean that just because you're in great pain and suffering that you're going to experience grace. No. It's only that when you are in great pain and suffering, you might experience grace. Those are the conditions under which you may have the experience of grace, as though previously you might be in despair.
Yeah,
And do nothing, therefore, around anything that contributes to whatever the ethical issues are.
What are we talking about when we're talking about grace?
Define grace.
I was taught by the Baptists that grace means unmerited favor.
Okay.
And all these 5 things that you have to do to experience grace, I don't believe you have to do anything. God decides whom he will endow with this gift. And it is a gift. And it is a gift that you receive without paying anything.
Try this change in the statement. Our understanding and appreciation of the grace we can receive might be affected by these things.
Well,
whatever this means.
Leisure of repeating myself again now. I'm not trying to be grandiose and preach, okay, but I can't help it. If you take everything you've got and you give it to the poor, these are the 5 things that are going to happen to you. you are going to become helpless, you're going to become homeless. All these things are going to happen to you. Now, grace is much closer. Because guess what? You don't have anything else. You know, that's what you'll get. You'll be looking for it everywhere. Where are you, Jesus, to save me? I did what you say. But this is horrible. You know, it will be too. In this society, if you, I know.
If people have
we've been there with nothing for a long, long time, okay? Well, I haven't been near nothing.
No,
but Tom is pretty close to nothing right now. And I didn't voluntarily give it all up, but I did lose it all. And it made me do that, all right? And my theory is that that's why he said to give everything to the poor. It wasn't just some a value thing so much as to get you in line for the grace, because after all, we can't do anything about hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes and tectonic plate shifts and all the ways that global warming has been. They say global warming is like these kind of things.
Alan, you're leaving things out. You present yourself as a Christian, and then you say that the Scripture says, give away everything, and that's what the Scripture says. And it doesn't say that. It says, give away everything and follow me.
That's what I said.
You left that part out.
Not earlier. He said that specifically.
Yeah, he did say
that. Well, I didn't hear it because it didn't sound like the lilies of the field, because the lilies of the field observably continue to flower and go through their phases.
Yeah. Well, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the Scripture, which you seem to be promoting, and yet you seem to be distorting it.
I'm distorting it?
Yes, it sounds like you're distorting it.
You just think I'm a hypocrite. Why don't you say that?
No, it doesn't mean you're a hypocrite.
I am a hypocrite.
Again, Bob, you did say that.
He did say that.
He did say that.
Well, then I didn't hear it. Did you? What did you hear that he said?
I heard him saying, give away everything you have and follow me.
Right.
He actually did say, and follow me.
Yes. Now, I was he said this twice.
It.
Once when I was over sitting sorting, and I heard that.
Yeah.
Right. This time he didn't say it, but I think, but those of us who heard it before understood that, right?
Well, okay. My assumption is that the and follow me would include all these things having to do with the separation from nature and the call to help the planet and so on and so on. And yet you seem to be presenting it without any of that.
Okay. Is this a romantic view of the world rather than a realistic view of the world?
What does that word realistic mean?
Jesus, the same question.
Well, the thing is, though, that this is my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, I read this in Thomas Cahill, that within the 400 years after Jesus, the powers that be that embraced Christianity because that would give them more power were kind of already interpreting it as, well, that's what Jesus said, but that's not what he meant, that you should give everything away. But maybe the problem is that to a certain extent that isn't quite what he meant. And that what we need to move toward in trying to practice that give everything away is not quite so extreme. Because, I mean, think about it. If I took everything I have and gave it away, then some people would have those things that I gave away. And then those people continue to give away. And it's not sustainable.
Yeah, you would
have. But if we moderated it, mm-hmm. if we could say, you know, I don't have to have quite so much. I've got what I need, so I can give more. I can give a lot, or you know, a portion of what I have away, and that can really help people, and that is more sustainable. I can't see a society where everybody is giving what they have away.
Well, I want to go back to Alan's point that only a homeless, like, see if I got this right, only a homeless person would experience what he's talking about in terms of grace.
No,
is that right or not?
No, that's not correct. Not only. I'm saying that if you get into that posture, then you'll look for it everywhere. You'll try, and it will be the only thing that sustains you, is because it's the only thing you have. All right, you're in the alley, all right, with a bottle of wine, all right, and the whores are walking in the alley with you, and the cops are going to come and beat you up or something you didn't do, shoot you 16 times. That's what will happen to you. All right, it's going on right now.
Well, it's also,
let me put this another way. Let's just go through when grace strikes us. It strikes us when we walk through the dark valley of a meaningless and empty life. It strikes us when we feel our separation is deeper than usual because we have violated another life, a life in which we loved or from which we were estranged. It strikes us when our disgust for our own being, our indifference, our weakness, our hostility, and our lack of discipline and composure have become intolerable to us. It strikes us when year after year, the longed-for perfection of life does not appear, when the old compulsions reign within us as they have for decades, when despair destroys all joy and courage. Now, did you experience this grace?
No.
Yes.
Do you experience grace when despair is destroyed? All you have is, you know, that's tough.
It says nothing about giving away all your possessions. It does say something about giving away pretense, giving away, realizing what's important in life and to you, and what isn't important. If you're living in McHenry County, it's kind of important to have an automobile. Is it important to have a house with 43 rooms? those are material things. Is it important to have I'm trying to think of an example. The adulation of everybody in town.
I would like to present that it's a possibility that these kinds of interpretations are not actually what is meant in response to the way Alan is presenting this. It would be like saying, it's a matter of who you be, the inside of what you're experiencing as in this word grace, which means gift. Okay, so it would be like you think you own a house, but it's perfectly possible for you to be aware that you don't own this house. It's there as a gift from the universe, and if it were not wood out in the forest, there never would have been wood enough to build your house, and it was all given to you, and you, quote, own it for the time being until the day you're dead, and then you don't own a damn thing.
I was thinking,
and so that this whole idea of ownership and and all of this, you can perceive all of that inside of an attitude of gratitude every single moment.
Yep. I was thinking of one way of putting it fairly succinctly, if not totally accurate. But Alan says, you know, she said, give away these things. What you can give away is your love of and dependence on these things.
Oh, yeah. Yes, oh, yeah. Now you're talking.
I want to say one thing to qualify this. You give everything away except one thing. You get to keep one thing. It's a measly little thing. It doesn't really amount to much. You know what you can keep? Love one another. And Jesus said that, or the myth. We don't believe in this Jesus alone here. The myth.
I have a real, real small
you don't get
point
to, you don't get to
small,
own your own love, even.
When Jesus did say this, okay, and he did, he said it to one person.
Who?
The man that came up to him, who said, I follow the commandments all my life, blah, 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 blah. But he was speaking to us all, sort of. But his the people closest to him, the 12 disciples, asked a question of him immediately after he said this. They said, well, then who can be saved, Lord? They were even questioning their own ability to be saved. And Jesus said, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich. He said, but with God, all things are possible.
Yes, that part is often left out.
Yep.
The last part. And it means, by the way, not that you don't own love, for crying out loud, Alan. That love also is a gift to you. And
that's hard.
It's unmerited.
It's just like when people say, I'm in love. Your presence just brings love to me. And it's like, I'm going to get married like you can marry. And then you put it in your pocket and you can take it out anytime you want. By the way,
I like that one.
All of this is not a form of ownership. Love is not a form of ownership. It's a form of giving up ownership.
This may or may not have been a song, but the phrase comes to mind, love's only love when you give it away.
Yeah, love is like a magic penny. Spend it, lend it, give it away, and you end up having more.
It's a talking about the musicals here.
That's a musical form.
Love is a verb also.
Things in musicals stick with us.
It is a verb.
Yeah.
I could imagine Grace. I mean, I could see, first of all, as comical as it probably seems, as laughable as it probably seems to people who are suffering economically, I would not be surprised to learn that many billionaires deep down feel that they have a meaningless and empty life.
Sure.
Because all that stuff,
feel what?
All that.
Meaningless.
Yeah.
I don't.
And empty life.
I think that wealthy people, super wealthy people, many of them do feel an emptiness and meaninglessness because those kinds of things don't bring meaning. And some of them do change their path because they come to this realization, and that realization could be a form of grace, and then they could change their actions. And the ones that don't do that, I think it's because money actually makes them sick.
They can't think clearly
because along with all your riches is the fear that you'll lose them. So then you feel like you've got to keep accumulating more and more, and it's never enough.
I think it was Johnny Carson's first huge contract with the networks, and someone said to him, wow, you don't have any problems at all. And he said, I may not have money problems, but that doesn't mean I don't have any problems.
Mm-hmm. Right. So sometimes money is the problem.
Yeah, money can own you.
Yeah, of course.
And just like poverty can also own you.
And you can worship money like a god. And that's
to quote the song you said, is that the love of money.
I'm
in danger of it every second.
People often quote, money is the root of all evil. That's
the love of
money. What about you? Does money own you?
Because money can, you can do a lot of good things with it.
I'm
not just mimicking you. That's a good answer for me, too. Although I think that you have a lot more money than I do.
I
think that says something.
I do now, but I've gone
way
through
more
poverty periods.
You've had
too,
it all your life.
And
too.
I'm very glad I had poverty periods.
And I'm glad you've had way more money all your life than me.
You don't know my
I
life.
I hope everybody has, or you what, told me. What you I hope everybody has a lot more money.
I never told you that I had more money than you my whole
poverty
life. I never said any such a thing. I don't know anything about that.
Okay, I'm sorry I blew your cover. or I said things that weren't entirely true. Or they were just lies. I'm getting infected with Trump.
Right. Well, welcome to the club. Maybe you're going to have an experience of grace in spite of it all.
In spite of it all?
In spite of whatever you just said.
Yeah. In spite of Trump existing.
In spite of Trump.
Yeah.
In spite of money, in spite of the lack of money, etc.
Say Paul, when he had persecuted Christians and he did this, that, and the other thing, and then he got grace. Yeah. Maybe Trump will get grace.
Well, what about that guy that...
Let's not hold our breath.
That
well, it's Trump's business.
What about the guy that wrote the song about grace, that he was on a slave ship and, you know...
You mean Amazing Grace?
Yeah, Amazing Grace.
A wretch like me. Yeah. He
was not just on a slave ship. He was the captain of the ship, I believe.
Oh, really? That's what that song is about?
No, it's obvious that if one is being captured by money, especially my own money, not necessarily the money of the world, but if I'm captured by... and a slave to my own money, it's pretty obvious that I'm not going to be very open to doing what might be needed to follow up on some of these ethical issues around...
It's the old saying, everybody has a price.
Well,
and your price may be not giving up something or whatever, but and it may not be monetary, but almost anything can be expressed in monetary terms.
Of course.
And we do that... Because it's a convenient.
I'm just now going to be going after this service to an interfaith meeting in Algonquin, and it's on the subject of love and money.
Oh, those kind of things.
Oh, I saw that in the heaven.
What faith meeting?
Love and money.
It's down in Algonquin, the Algonquin Public Library, and it's being sponsored by Faith Bridge.
Now, I have to joke. Is this like something illegal? Love and money? No.
I don't know what they're going to say, but I'm bringing along the text of that little song that I made a mess of a few minutes ago.
Russ, is grace an attitude thing? I mean, it's the way you look at the gifts that you get. Is it just an attitude that you take toward them?
I think it could be, you know, that when you heard it from Tom, he was giving you a sort of a radical, almost like a completely passive interpretation. I myself would think it's going to be available to you, and it probably, if I were just speaking, doing a sermon or something, I might say, it's available to you at all times. You only have to just decide to choose it. You have to choose it.
What is available, Bob? What is available to you?
Whatever is meant by this.
Oh, okay. I see. Grace?
Yeah, whatever is meant by it, which means gift. It means gift. In a moment, I can accept whatever is happening as a gift.
Sure.
Even when I get up in the morning and I feel like I can almost fall over, I'm so stuck in the gloom of my dreams, I can just barely accept that it's a gift just to be able to get out of bed.
I got to say that this whole discussion, up until very recently, the term grace and the concept had no meaning for me whatsoever. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what people were talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's only in the last few years that I've begun to get a glimmering of really understanding. Mm-hmm. And I'm not there yet. So talking about grace is difficult for me because it was just not part of my being. It may have been there. You know, I may have received a lot of grace, but it didn't. You know,
it's amazing to me to hear you say that because I thought you interpreted it pretty well about 5 minutes ago.
I probably do today, but do I really internalize it?
Well,
I'm going to piggyback on that because it's my turn. I actually share a lot, and maybe it's genetic, but grace didn't have a lot of meaning to me. So we talked about grace several years ago at church. There was one month when grace was our theme, and we talked about it quite a lot in small group discussions. And I think that what my experience of grace is, what comes the closest to what I can call grace, is those moments in my life when I feel connected. Connected to God, connected to people, connected to nature, and I think those are moments that I've been gifted with, that feeling of connection. And to tie it all together for me, I think sometimes when we have money, we can use that money to separate ourselves from other people. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's how we're using money, is building fences or buying bigger property so we can keep ourselves a little more separate, then we're using that money to not receive grace or to prevent being in contact with grace. And I wanted to just bring in one little piece, and I wish I could remember where exactly I've read it, but in some Native American cultures, there are times during the year or times during someone's life when they do give away everything. And they give away everything in their home, their cooking utensils, everything. However, when you look at their situations, they also never have nothing. Because as a part of a tribe, they always have access to adequate food and adequate shelter. So there's a difference in a situation like that, in giving away everything you own, and maybe that is a way of connecting with people and receiving grace through that connection. But you're not really giving away your ability to have more days to accumulate things to give away.
I'm very tuned in to everything you're saying, but I would just put a little proviso. There's a great book on gift called, it's called Gift. It's a great book, and it specifically goes into this Native American tradition you're talking about, and it specifically makes clear to those of us that read that book that in those tribal settings, it becomes an instrument of power to give away everything. And people who are risking that they will either end up in so much poverty or they will be elected to be the chief in the next election by having given it all away. So it becomes a power play at a high risk level.
In certain tribes you're talking about.
Well, that's the way it's described in this book.
I would argue that what
your
risk is
much better.
Well, and my version is going from memory of something I'm not even sure I understood.
Which was beautiful. Yeah.
But when I put it, I was thinking about what you said about Jesus saying giving everything away, I think that for some people to give everything away is different than for others. If
it could well be.
I don't know. One of Trump's kids said, "You know what? That's right. I'm going to give everything away," and he could give everything away that he owns. He's never going to want for anything. Despite the fact that he gives everything away.
Yeah, it's just like...
So it's a different experience for different people.
Yeah, in almost any setting, there's that ambiguity that goes on. In Christian circles, you gain power by being as humble as possible. So humility now becomes your instrument for power.
Yeah.
And so you have a bunch of styles of humility so as to get more power. And then you begin to discover that the surface of things is hiding its own opposite. And that is often happening. And so what do you do when you're faced with that kind of awareness? Now you're right back here. This is what is meant by being faced with despair. I don't even know how I could behave in such a way that I could not be accused by others and by myself as being imperfect, not doing what is really needed, using it as a hypocrisy, etc., etc. And now is the moment when something may happen. I'm accepted anyway. Do I accept being accepted, or do I wish to continue to punish myself? Or will I follow the stricture that says, love your enemy and be aware the enemy is me?
Yeah.
Yep, rat.
Yep. Yeah. Getting back to grace, I remember times in my life, hard times, when I got things I didn't deserve and people came into my life that I didn't know they would be there for me. So that's the way I experienced grace in the past.
Bob Jackson, what you just said requires so much thought to understand.
Yeah.
Love your enemy and the enemy is me.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that means that you recognize all the bad things about yourself.
Yes.
And you still love yourself. That's so hard to do.
Of course. Nobody ever thought that was easy.
Yeah.
And when you are able possibly to do it, you want to praise the source of being itself.
And
you can be so grateful because it seems as though it's so impossible.
I can't. I tried.
Well, you can't do it by your own trying. You yourself said that. Give up trying.
Didn't we just...
So love may be the wrong word.
Tilly's word is acceptance.
Well, it's, I'm, of course, using, you know, I'm attempting to interpret what I think I'm hearing here, so I'm not going to use his exact terms, but how do you, what do you mean by love?
Didn't
if it doesn't mean also mutual acceptance.
Didn't we just...
Not only I accept myself, knowing that I'm not being right, but also accept the other, knowing that they also are not right.
Do you accept the action, though? Do you actually accept the action?
Am I supposed to brag, or would you rather I act humble?
Did we not recently sing a song about that?
Well, you be humble.
Didn't we just sing a song, what was it? We forgive ourselves and each other, we begin again. Didn't we just sing that just a couple weeks ago? We forgive ourselves and each other.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And then we
begin again in love.
Begin again in love.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a nice expression of it.
But
yeah.
Love can be used carelessly. I love hamburgers.
Of course. Of course. It's such a huge, ambiguous word.
My mother always said, you can't love anything that can't love you.
But it's the most powerful word in the universe, because God is love. If God is love, God is the most powerful spirit in the universe. So what I do for myself, if I'm feeling bad, because I do breathing, and I say I have God's unconditional love, and then I breathe out all the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And this ex-priest Ron Roth, what he taught me. This is what I do for myself. Now, it is your only goal is peace, and your only function is forgiveness, forgiving yourself, and from that everything else will come.
But that idea of God being love is not part of every religious tradition on this planet.
Well, for me, it's power.
But you said God is love,
yeah.
But Christians believe that, but Jews don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Jewish God is a very...
Well, are some Christians who I would argue don't truly believe
they profess it.
They
believe God is love for those who act the way they think they are.
I hate to be difficult, but in 10 minutes, in less than 10 minutes, we have to have this table cleared off.
Okay.
And... seated in the sanctuary.
We're over time.
Or gone if you're gone, if you're not going.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know why you make such a big distinction between Christians and Jews, because according to certain modalities, including one that I would assert myself, being a Christian is a way that people not born of the seed of Abraham can get to be a Jew.
Yeah, that's right.
Say that again.
Hey, John. I'm just